So, good morning, everybody. I am Patty Niebergall, Privacy and Protocol Officer here at the University of Regina, and a member of our University of Regina governance team up on the fifth floor of the Ad Hum building. So, thank you for attending today's Privacy and Access Workshop with Dave and I. And as we begin, we will acknowledge the discussion is being delivered on Treaty 4 lands. Some individuals may be present from Treaty 6. There are territories of the Nahiwak, Anishinaabeg, Dakota, Lakota, Nakota, and the homeland of the Métis Mischief Nation. So welcome. Just a few housekeeping things that questions can be asked in the chat. So I'll monitor that, and I think Stacey's going to monitor it too. So we should be able to pick that up for you, Dave, and let you know if there's a question. And if others can just keep their audio on mute and your camera off, unless you have a question, of course, that would be great. So I will now introduce Dave. Dave Meldrum is our compliance and contracts advisor, and he's our head of privacy and access at the university. So over to you, Dave.
Thank you, Patty. Thanks for joining us this morning, everyone. Thanks for the introduction. My role here at the university is in part to lead and manage privacy breach investigations and develop and implement and monitor risk mitigation plans and respond to access to information requests. So part of that role is to promote a culture of compliance and diligence around privacy and access issues at the university. I hope to have a fairly informal, discussion here today. I think this is being recorded, so I will probably stick closely to my speaking notes on this, probably maybe a little more than I normally do. I've put up a slide now that has an agenda for the discussion. Really, it's not a strict agenda. And so, as Patty said, if you've got questions as we go along, please feel free to interrupt. But I will kind of work through my speaking notes. The overall objective is to give a bit of a refresher. So I don't know, maybe people on the call have attended some of the other sessions that we've done. This one's a little different because it's hopefully a little more tailored more to the research environment, but there will be elements of the sort of standard roadshow we've been on for the past couple of years in delivering these sessions, but with a little tailoring to research. So the overall objective is to just build awareness partly of our office, but also of sort of the rules that apply. We can't cover absolutely everything in the hour we've got, everything that you need to know, but to give you some awareness and tools to assist with issues. So, and I always include in this slide when I talk about it, what I hope to get out of the discussion. It won't be comprehensive or perfect. I'm happy to receive feedback on what you'd like to hear more of. I know we have another session slated for I think February 24th, so hopefully everybody here can attend or watch that one. I'm hoping out of this one to maybe spark ideas because this is more of our standard roadshow today. The one in a month might be a little more issues that arise between now and that day that we can drill down into a little, maybe hopefully more of the hypotheticals that come up or questions that I can't answer today that maybe you'll try to build that one around what comes out of today. So hopefully we do get some good discussions. I will deliver a discussion. I'm thinking it's probably going to be about 30 minutes is my speaking plan. Like say, interrupt if you'd like. The slideshow that I've got here is only meant for our frame of discussion. We'll go into like say specific examples, hopefully as and maybe just raised by people in attendance. So please feel free, like I said, to interrupt. We always start with the law. I often always start with the law. What governs access and privacy at the university? The slide here on the screen shows a number of different acts and legislation at the provincial, federal, and even international level. Which law applies tends to rest on who the entity or people who are. Who are actually in custody of and managing information. It's important to know for both access and privacy rules. The U of R, including all the academic faculties, is subject primarily to the local authority Freedom of Information and Protection of Privacy Act, LaFOIP. You'll probably hear me say that a number of times this morning. And to a lesser degree, when it's offering healthcare services or dealing with student staff and faculty health information, the Health Information Protection Act, HIPAA. So the two Saskatchewan pieces at the top of the slide. Saskatchewan also has a Privacy Act that is more of a you've invaded my privacy, I'm going to sue you kind of act, which is less applicable to institutions, but is more sort of a person to person sort of tort sort of legislation. This discussion will focus probably primarily on LaFoyt, unless questions take us other ways. There may be some discussion on the general data protection regulations in Europe. I think that's still considered sort of a gold standard of privacy law. Comment on LaFoyt is that it was first drafted in 1993. The Privacy Commissioner and other quarters have been, advocating heavily for overhaul and upgrade of those privacy laws, but it's the law we've got right now, so it's the one we deal with. General principles of LaFoyt, as our primary privacy and access legislation, the general principle, all the information the university possesses, no matter how it acquired it or how it's been developed, is public information. That's kind of the, like, of course, there's exceptions to that, but you kind of think of that as you go through your work, like what you're producing in the course of the work, the research you do, or the, any transacting we do as employees of the university or as faculty and staff, it's all potentially public. As the name suggests, however, LaFoyt is a balancing act, right? Balancing freedom of information with protection of privacy. But it's about public institutions operating in the bright light of day and people having a right to know what goes on at the university. It's a publicly funded institution. There's other confidentiality type considerations, which we'll talk about at length here momentarily. But, it's like that principle is the starting point is everything we do is public. And then you kind of carve off from that. That's my view of the legislation for sure. And as the quoted on the slide, section five, that's really where that principle starts from. So, again, it's a bit of a duplicate slide, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. But again, that balancing act, records are public, some information has to be protected. So we talk about records. What does a record look like? We looked at section five. There are exceptions to what is a record. The first bullet point on your screen is taken straight from LaFoyt again, and it's the definition of record. It looks pretty broad, but it's narrower than maybe first meets the eye because it doesn't include things like research and study notes. It doesn't include teaching materials, reports, publications, and personal communications of university employees, unless prepared in the context of university work. So, my personal emails to friends, what are we doing, Friday night? Are we going for drinks? Are we going to that show or whatever? That, is not necessarily public information and it can be protected. But if you include that in a comment at the end of a business email, then that gets murky. So you always be careful about those communications. But really, the key here is that, the records that are prepared in the conduct of work are university records. There are then again, as we get into access, records that we don't necessarily have to disclose. They'll still be records. They'll fit that definition, but they might not have to be disclosable, or they may have to be disclosable. The other point on that slide, it only includes existing records. This is an interesting one because in the 3 years that I've been here, it's happened a couple of times where we've had access requests where really what it amounts to is somebody's asking for us to develop a record. Can you provide an analysis? It's probably not, quite the way it's worded, but can you provide us with these? We don't have to do that. We kind of have to just provide what we're required, what already exists as a record. If we don't do certain analysis, we're not obligated to prepare that for somebody making an access to information request. If they say, what are your statistics on X? If we've never prepared those statistics and we don't have any record of those statistics, we don't have to do that at that request. There's, rules around that too. There's nuance in all of this, but a basic principle is we don't have to provide records that don't already exist. So, which gets us into a key element of university functioning, or any organization for that matter, is records and information management, and how long we have to keep records, and what form and manner in which they're stored. Records and information management schedules create a framework for the manner, electronic or paper or otherwise, the duration and subject matter is to be systematically retained by the university. Before a RIM schedule is adopted, it is reviewed by legal counsel and the University Records and Information Management Committee for compliance with the law and appropriateness in the university context. So it's a strong recommendation here is to know RIM schedules. They should be consulted and observed. They assist us not just with identifying what is stored, but how long it must be kept and when it should be destroyed. Strong adherence to these schedules can save a lot of work and limit a great deal of risk in not having to dig for and produce old records that are no longer relevant. And it should be noted that all records related to a request generally have to be produced if they still exist. Just a bit of an aside from my notes. It is a defense to say that, we had this information. If somebody says, well, what happened 15 years ago? And we say, well, those records are over whatever the retention period is. They passed that. We've destroyed the records in accordance with our policy and our record schedules. Here's our proof of destruction. We don't have to produce that information is a valid defense to the, production of records that we may or may not want to, actually produce. So, but on the other hand, if you haven't followed the schedule, if for whatever reason you're allowed to destroy it, but you didn't, you would still have to produce it. So, records and information management program is pretty central to access to information, particularly. And so I'd encourage to to look at those schedules. And if there isn't one developed for your area, our area, oops, I kind of skipped a slide there. Our area in privacy and access, and also the university archives area, is willing to assist in developing those schedules. So I've talked about the fact that we have to make information available as a public institution. They're listed on this slide and the following two slides. I've got several categories of information that doesn't have to be disclosed. And those are found in sections 13 to 23 of LAFOIP, can, or in some cases must be held from disclosure due to their sensitive nature. So we've already seen on this slide, the decision to conceal or refuse is mandatory. The first bullet point I put mandatory in brackets there. Sometimes, it's a discretionary exemption where, we can choose to not disclose information. So there is an option whether we have to or not. But there's nuance to each of these exemptions, and I'm not going to go deeply into detail on all of them, but just a couple that might be applicable to the research environment. Next slide, even more categories. Most notable is most notable is the last bullet point, personal information. We'll go into that fairly in fair detail in a few minutes here, but note that withholding personal information is a mandatory exemption from the duty to release information. We're not allowed to say we're going to release this personal information on some individual just because we think it's more transparent or something like that. And that's kind of the key to any of the mandatory exemptions. We have to withhold certain information. So the final slide on exemptions, and probably the two that might most apply in the research environment. This is my thinking. Audience people might disagree. Records containing trade secrets and details of academic research. The first one is basically, that's sort of the intellectual property, economic interests of a third party. Note that that is listed as a mandatory exemption. So the university is obligated in an access to information request, third party information that might impact their economic interests. We don't have the option. We have to, conceal that from disclosure. We can't disclose that information in in an access request. The second one, details of research, obviously an important one. I'm not sure if this exemption exists in parallel legislation in other parts of the country. I've looked in a few. I haven't seen it in other places, but that I haven't thoroughly surveyed other jurisdictions. In La Foip, it's largely specific to the U of R and the University of Saskatchewan exemption. It does have some application to records held by health organizations. And to claim this exemption, all the elements have to be met. You must be research conducted in the course of employment. So the side research, you know, if you're using the university tools and I'm losing the word, but if we're using resources of the university, I'd be really careful because it might be subject to disclosure. But one of the intents, I think, is that an access request should not allow a competitor researcher or somebody else to access research in a sort of a pre-publication phase. Once research is published, of course, it's by definition available. It's part of the purpose of publishing it. I don't think I need to tell this audience that. But it's an important exemption because research that's in progress is exempt from disclosure. We may have to, and I think it became a case in front of the courts a few years ago, disclose the title of an amount of funding being received, like who's funding the research, but the actual research itself, the details of it prior to publication can be withheld. And it's not a mandatory exemption, that last one either. Like it's a it may be withheld, it doesn't have to be, and that's up to the privacy head, which is my role, and also when I review these, I consult with the researchers, saying, are you comfortable with this being released? So at least there's that opportunity. There's a few other categories of exemption that I think are probably less relevant to this discussion, so I won't go deeply into them. There's health and safety stuff that if somebody's health and safety could be harmed, you wouldn't disclose that. It kind of ties closely to personal information. Records of draft university legislation or regulations or bylaws. Again, drafts, not the final documents are public. Those sorts of things. So there's a few other ones that weren't on the slides here, but I won't go deeply into them. When we're withholding information in an access request, if we're claiming an exemption, I shouldn't say when we're withholding, I guess just say when we're disclosing information and we're deciding to withhold some of it related to the request, we claim an exemption. Anytime we claim an exemption, we have to give the reasons why we're declining to provide that record and the specific legal justification. We do actually have to quote the section and subsection of La Foip within the documents, why we, redacted, blacked out something. We have to be very specific. There is minimization principles at work that state that we need to withhold only as much information as we're permitted or required to withhold based on the legal exemption claimed. So it's not enough just to say, well, I'm not going to give you this because of La Foip. You have to be very specific about it. I see Victor has his hand up. How long has your hand been up, Victor?
I think since the second slide, Dip.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's all right. My questions are actually fairly specific to the type of role that I play. You had a slide at the beginning that outlined the types of laws and legislation that apply in Canada to this. Right there, one next one, that one. When we're writing agreements with American parties, are there standard US laws or legislation that we should be including in agreements of that type? Or is it just too wide open, like state by state?
That's probably pretty broad, and I think you have to look at it on an agreement by agreement basis, Victor. I
Okay.
think we might be dealing with somebody in Maryland or somebody in Arizona, if that's and there'll be different privacy laws. There are information that we're subject to and disclosure, and I do have a slide on some of the clauses that we put into our contracts coming up here,
Okay,
because I think it kind of ties into that discussion. So I'll get to that in a moment too. And
sure. And then there was one other question that occurred to me just at the beginning of your La Foip discussion, is that with the onset of AI and all of these AI search engines that are going through, thousands and thousands and thousands of documents to pull out information for AI, I'm wondering if under La Foip we should be considering entering new wording into U of R research agreements that is that defines what's confidential. And you know, I'm wondering whether or not this would provide any protection under AI searches.
Yeah, that's a tough question. You know, again, it's the information that's being fed into the tools. So I think we also have to understand, you know, we're feeding information into OpenAI, just as an example, or ChatGPT or whatever. That, you know, there's more and more of these coming online all the time. We are what it's incumbent on us to understand is to know what that tool is going to do with that information and it, how it's going to give it. It's a basic principle. How long is the counterparty, in this case, the AI tool, going to keep this information, what it's going to do with it, to understand that in some cases, like as the name OpenAI kind of suggests, is that this tool is, you know, open and will be used. So the next person who asks a query, this will end up in the database. It may or may not inform that other query that's totally unrelated to, you know, whatever you entered that information for, but it's now in the AI tool and it's going to inform that analysis. That can have research implications. I've mostly dealt with that in sort of privacy situations where, you know, I've been getting these questions about, you know, how much can we scrub personal information out of AI tools, you know, before we enter into you know, using the AI tool. So how much, you know, obviously we want to scrub it all out. Yeah. One of the principles of that is, and like generally when we de-identify data, how easily can it be re-engineered to be sort of re-identified to the individual.
Personally identifiable, yes.
Yeah, you know, so I don't have a great answer on that one, Victor. And
yeah,
that might
I mean,
be a next session kind of question that we could look into and do some research
yeah,
on.
Yeah, I just want to just add one more layer to this.
Yeah.
And yeah, for the next session, yeah, please invite me to it because I'm constantly dealing with this lately. And you know, just at the risk of sounding like one of these people whose hair is on fire because Donald Trump is coming to power in 4 days
in
or three
days.
Days.
Yeah.
But I mean, he's surrounding himself, you know, with these people who run these social media companies, and they're pushing very, very hard to eliminate any AI regulation. I'm wondering if we need to think about contractual ways to protect the data inside AI, because I, you know, my personal belief is that they're going to create AI tools that will allow them to manipulate the AI results to say what they want them to say, and at the same time claim, well, AI, you know, went through 50,000 documents to get to this, so it must be true.
Yeah.
But we don't know what they're taking and what they're not taking. And so that's where I start to get really nervous about this. So I'm wondering if we need to find some contractual ways to protect these documents and using Lefwaite principles, I guess. So that's kind of where I'm thinking about going.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I don't have a lot to add to that comment, Victor, other than I think that's a really good observation. You know, whether it's the US government or any actor who, you know, wants to do this, you know, it's a risk. And whether it's personal information or the expropriation of people's research, right? You know, public, you know, public or pre-published research, you know, and you know, the misinformation world, right? So
yeah, it's going to have a lot of implications with the protection of intellectual property
yeah.
too. So
yeah.
Okay, sorry, my hand is down now. I'll let you get back.
No,
where you
no,
are.
That's fine. Sorry, I didn't see it earlier.
No, it's okay.
So I think we were talking about claiming an exemption. So the law is, anyway, as it currently stands, and like I said at the beginning too, you know, Lefwaite has been amended over the years, but it was first written in 1993, and there's I think some need to update the legislation around this, and law always has a hard time, I think, keeping up with tech these days. So like I said, we have to make sure that we can point to where in the act, if we're withholding information, where in the act, you know, that authority or requirement to withhold information resides. And we have to make that apparent to the requester of the information. And as well, individuals who have requested information, they have a right to ask the privacy commissioner to review whether the university has appropriately disclosed this information, and the university is obligated to inform individuals of this right when responding to these access requests. As we said a minute ago, there's a slide on contracts. As it stands right now, and I apologize for the really small font on this one. It looks smaller on my screen now. It looks maybe a little better in this presentation. A lot of our contracts and a clause like this one should be in most research contracts. It might not be word for word, but this tells the other party that the university is subject to, you know, legislation that may require it to disclose their information, that they need to be aware of that. So it partly protects the university from, you know, if the law requires us to disclose information, even though you don't want it disclosed, we're obligated to do that, and you signed an agreement that permits it. It doesn't absolve the university of all of its obligations in these regards. Some categories of exemption are mandatory, but you know, organizations should be made aware that if they've got information that's confidential, they need to be clear about what they consider confidential information. Sometimes we obligate them, you know, to mark any information that's confidential as such, or otherwise we'll treat it as sort of, I don't want to call it open information, but disclosable information. Again, information that might impact, that fits that sort of exemption under LaFOIP, around economic interests and third-party intellectual property rights, is a mandatory exemption. So it's arguable that the third party would have to ask for that, you know, confidentiality. We have to be really careful in those circumstances about not disclosing that information. So, but I put this on the slide because we do put this in agreements to make sure that the third party funding agencies particularly are aware and acknowledge that we have obligations under LaFOIP.
So Dave, can I just jump in here? Oh, well, you're just
Absolutely.
Getting to it now. I was just going to say that personal information, personally identifiable information, mm-hmm. personal health information, you're just getting to that.
Yeah. And again, it's a key exemption. If anybody's attended my other roadshow, I usually put all the personal information in front, and I go into access to information, and I've kind of flipped the order of that in this one. So we'll get into it because it is one of the biggest exemptions. And in research, you know, especially research involving human subjects and that sort of thing, you know, probably broader than that, but personal information comes up a lot. You know, so one of the standard slides that I've used is this one. It's defined, personal information is defined in the legislation. You know, some of the categories are listed on screen. It's not a direct quote from the legislation. There are things that are, I think probably a lot of them are fairly obvious, like, you know, ID numbers, social insurance numbers, you know, financial information, medical history, which is a bit of a crossover to HIPAA, which I'm not going deeply into today, but the biggest takeaway is to understand, you know, personal information, a lot of it is fairly intuitive. You know, what would we not want to disclose? I always say in these discussions, you know, if you're in doubt about something, pretend it is personal information until you find out it isn't, because it's sort of like, you know, you can't put that rain back up in the sky kind of thing. Once it's been released, and then there's risk there. So just know that the legislation has a very specific definition of personal information, and that should be consulted. Obviously, my office is there to help out with that, too. We go into consent. No personal information can be collected or disclosed without knowledge or consent, preferably in writing. Data minimization principles and a core principle of privacy is that only as much personal information as is necessary to fulfill the purpose should be collected. Don't just be collecting a bunch of additional information when, you know, just because you've got the person there, or, you know, they're enrolling in this study or they're being recruited for this study. The corollary to that too is that once collected, that information is only to be used for the purposes for which it was collected, and for, you know, what was explained to the individual, what they're consenting to. just because you have it and you collect it and you got their permission, obviously because they gave it to you, doesn't mean, later down the road you say, hey, I've got all that information on these people from that study. Maybe I can re-engineer that into this other issue. Then you'd have to pretty much go back and collect consent again. The important thing is we respect the reasons for which we collected the information in the first place. For some uses of information and in the general roadshow sort of presentation, I use student enrollment. We get as the university for our students, we get their permission in a general sort of consent when they enroll. And I'll talk about that in the next slide. Generally, as I say, it's better to get written permission. Always better to have a written record, although in certain circumstances, very transactional type of one-off things, oral consent and implied consent are sometimes sufficient. Sometimes it's kind of obvious in the context that somebody's asking you to, I don't have a great example off the top of my head, but somebody's asking you to do something and they give you personal information. You have their consent to use that personal information to carry out that task. Those are often very transactional, very not ongoing types of consent.
I just jump in here with another hypothetical for the next meeting. We're running into circumstances occasionally with some of the researchers that I'm working with whose employers are wanting to have access to certain personal information about those individuals so that they can create interventions for the protection of the mental health of their employees. And what I'm talking about, an example would be, if a police officer is involved in a shooting, they would immediately be required to go talk to the psychologist in their department. So some of the research that's underway is actually, obtaining certain personal information from members that would be similarly traumatic or PTSD triggering or something like that that their employers want to know about so they can actually send them to the psychologist. The question would be, because I'm not sure we're completely clear on this at this point in time, how do we push back against these employers who have the best interests of their employees in mind, but by the same token, not violate our privacy rules or LaFoyP rules or something like that. So for the next meeting, maybe we can add something like that to the list.
Briefly, I'd say there's a lot of obligation on that employer, right? What consent did you, I'll say, what consent did you have from your members as a condition of employment? And as employees, we give our employer quite a bit of leeway in what they can do with our information that might not really be apparent to us. So we say informed consent. There's quite a few exceptions under the Act that I don't get into in these presentations deeply, where you can actually use somebody's personal information. Part of this presentation is to just drill home the basic concept of,
Yeah, that's why
you
I'm thinking
want
about it for the
consent, you
next.
want people to know about it. There are a lot of exceptions. So yeah, I think we can probably go a little deeper if, if that's part of what we collect. But just briefly, you would look to that employer to say, what authority have you used to collect this information, for us to do research when, it could be a condition of employment. Anytime a firearm is discharged in the line of duty, I don't know that you might, that's subject to an investigation. It might or might not require, psychological review and assistance, for want of a better term. But there are certain conditions that's just a condition of employment. As a condition of employment, when I worked at Credit Union Central of Saskatchewan, is I had to have an account at a credit union. I didn't before. I had to go open that up. But if I wanted to get paid, I had to do
Fair
that,
enough.
right? So there are some sort of coercive conditions, and yeah, we can go more deeply in the next. But as a university, you want to make sure what right they had and what they've told their employees, what's going to happen with this information when they do get the counseling. Is it then going to be used, as data for subsequent research? And I think that is fair to ask.
One more layer to this, just two would be, where does consent come from? Does it have to come from the individual themselves, or could it come through a negotiated union agreement?
And I think it can come through a negotiated agreement, but is the agreement sufficiently clear? As a member, the university, as a member of a union, the university or any body, any corporate body could assume that the members have read their CBA, right? They certainly have access to it and they're aware of those conditions under that. If it's in the CBA, I don't know off the top of my head what entirely is in those
Sorry to
CBAs.
interrupt, but
But
just.
no, those are good questions, and that's part of obtaining consent, right? And what is the information on it, and is it informed consent? How far can you stretch that? And some of it is open to interpretation, so it's a good question, and I think it's a good follow-up discussion. Any other questions? I'm kind of plowing through here. So I see it's about 20 to 12. So again, in the undergraduate calendar, we put a fairly broad consent on personal information. It's been up on your screen now for a minute or two. It does give the university the ability to share information internally to administer programs. So this is an example. It doesn't include student associations, URSU, or other organizations. Though the consent is given broadly to the university, access to personal information of students and others is strictly on a need-to-know basis, another important principle of most privacy legislation. I often use this because it's just an easy example. Employees of the university may be given access to databases like Banner, and you'll have a broad access to it, right? You could go look up any one of our 17,000 students if you have that access. You're only supposed to look at that information. You're not allowed to look at it, unless you have a reason to look at it, like to fulfill your job. If you've got a request about a certain number of students need to be, I mean, I don't know what you use fully, what you use Banner for on a day-to-day basis, but to administer, courses and that sort of thing, to develop class lists and that sort of stuff, you would go and do that. I'm not sure how manual that is these days, but as an example, you can't just go and look at something just because you have access, right? So we have rules against things like snooping and looking at information for purposes other than administering the university and its programs. So I've got a what do you need to know slide here. I don't know that I need to go deeply into that one. Like I say, strictly on a need to know basis is what when you're dealing with personal information, that's kind of the principle we have to follow. The university has a number of policies and procedures around access and privacy. That's on our pages, which I don't know if Patty's putting the link in the chat or not. I'd
It's
encourage
there now,
you to
Dave.
look at that. I think we're still in the old format on our webpage. I think we're in the process of getting this developed. We'd hoped to have it done earlier, but there's been some delays on some stuff that has to go on ahead of ours. But nonetheless, we do have a page that's applicable still. It just looks like it came from 1997, but we'd encourage you to view that. I always include a slide on breaches of privacy. If you've discovered a breach, really the information is, we have a protocol when a privacy breach happens, and they do. People try not to, have it happen, but mistakes get made. So we do have a process, and that basic process is as sort of just defined by the legislation. There are five principles. They're based on five principles recommended by the Privacy Commissioner. A, contain the breach. B, notification principles. In terms of determining whether the individuals affected need to be notified of the breach, or if we don't think there's a real risk of significant harm, we might do more harm by notifying than we do by just containing it. We investigate it further, so that sort of notification principle kind of feeds through all that while we're through the other steps. We prevent future breaches, and we write a privacy breach report. And really, most of those steps are the responsibility of my office. We hold and file, the reports if the privacy commissioner comes knocking on our door, and wants to examine our response in a breach situation. So really, that's all I had to say about that. And I think we have another link on the slide there. So our final slide is contact us. Again, one of the at the outset, one of the things that I really wanted to get home is our office exists. And when you have questions and they're not always easy to answer, we're here to work through them with you and to provide our insights on what happens. All access to inform all formal access to information requests and privacy breach issues should come through our office before information is released under a FOIP request or if you have a privacy breach. We're not here to punish people for privacy breaches. We're here to help them work through them. So that's all I've got for this session. It's about 11:45. So I don't know if there's further questions or anything came through in the chat, Patty or Stacy.
There's no other questions posted, so if people have questions, they're welcome to turn their camera on and ask.
Or your at least your microphone, if not your
Yeah, or your
camera.
microphone, yeah.
Well, like I say, we are kind of, the second session. This is first part of two sessions that we're hoping to deliver. We've got a couple of ideas for things that we'd like to discuss. If you have anything you would like to get a little more information on and work through it in this type of format, before what is the date of that session? February 21st, I want to say. Is
We
that
have a
correct?
plan.
I think that's correct. Please reach out to us and we can build into some discussion. It might be maybe not, it might be a little disjointed in terms of two or three or four different topics, but we
I
definitely
think
would.
it's Friday, February 21st, Dave.
Yeah,
It
the
is.
21st.
It's and it's 11, so same time as today.
Same time and it'll be recorded like this one was, so. All right.
So if there's no other questions, then if people do have questions, they're welcome to email Dave and I at privacy.access@uregina.ca. And our new website, like Dave said, we hope it'll be launched soon. It's ready. It's just waiting to get put into the new U of R web platform. And that's all. Thanks for attending. And Victor, if you have any questions, you know where to get a hold of us.
Yeah, no, thanks. I appreciate it. I'm almost wondering, Dave, whether or not it would be smart for us to have you come and address ORPI, so that we can get into some of these things just with the contract writers rather than waste time with everybody. So,
Maybe that might be something as well.
yeah. Besides, after 2 years, you and I ought to meet face to face rather than just over
On
Zoom sometimes. So.
our monitors. That's
Yeah.
good.
All
All right.
right,
Okay.
but good presentation. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks.
Thanks,
Guys,
everyone.
thank you. David, I'm laughing because I'm like, you're going to be spending.